Everyone, this is Andrew. Welcome to Keen on America. On July 4th, 2026, America will be 250 years old, an anniversary that will, no doubt, be greeted with a mixture of celebration, contemplation, and resignation. In Keen on America, we talk to prominent US citizens not just about their country's past and present, but also about its future. What, I ask my American guests, will be the 21st century fate of their now venerable republic? Hello, everyone. Welcome to Keen on America, where I talk to very, very prominent Americans about themselves, their work, their sense of their country's past and future. We've had a very couple of wonderful shows in the last couple of weeks. One with the UC Berkeley sociologist, Arlie Russell Hochschild. Many of you will be familiar with her book, Strangers in Their Own Land, a very influential book about how to breach the divides in America between the coasts and the interior. And then earlier this week with Felton Henderson, the first black judge in California, an enormously influential figure in legal history. And what tied Arlie Hochschild and Felton Henderson together, in my view, is that they both articulated their coming of age in the 1960s during the civil rights marches and movements and politics and indeed even violence. And my guest today is a particularly distinguished American. Sarah Paretsky doesn't need much of an introduction. She's one of America's leading writers and arguably its leading crime writer. She's the inventor, of course, of V.I. Varshavsky, the great female detective. And I was listening to Sarah on another podcast on the Axe Files with David Axelrod. And in a wonderful conversation she had with David, Sarah, like Arlie Hochschild and Felton Henderson, spoke about her coming of age in the 1960s during civil rights demonstrations in Chicago. So I thought that might be a good place for us to begin with, Sarah. Perhaps you might talk a little bit about that. I know you've already talked to Axelrod on it, but you can enrich that conversation with our audience.
Thanks very much, Andrew. Excuse me. I came to Chicago. I was 19. I had grown up and lived in Kansas, I grew up in the country. So I was a rural person coming to the big city for essentially the first time. I answered a call from the local civil rights leadership looking for college students that they could embed in neighborhoods and help respond to what they knew was going to be a violent summer. I don't think anyone knew that it would be as violent as it became, with white riots protesting any expansion of the very limited rights that African Americans had in the city. So I worked for a man, a Presbyterian minister named Tom Phillips, who was probably the best manager I ever worked for in the many years that I spent in corporate life. And he had us so involved in the community, in the city, that even though I'm not sure we did much good with our immediate charge, which was to try to do soft propaganda with some 6 to 10 year olds in the neighborhood on alternatives to diversity and alternatives to rock throwing as a way of handling a diverse population. But he got us so involved in the city that when I graduated from university the next year, I came back and Chicago became my home.
In our conversations with Arlie and Felton and others in this series, we focused on that experience and the experience of what it meant to be an American. Did you define or redefine yourself as an American in the 60s as you went through the civil rights, both personally and politically? You went through the civil rights era.
You know, I grew up, I am the grandchild of immigrants, not the child of immigrants, but my grandparents, who were Eastern European Jews, made it to America by the skin of their teeth. Everyone in their families who was behind in Europe was murdered in the Shoah. And so I grew up with a particular vision of America as this place, this kind of beacon of hope, freedom, liberty, and so on. And so I think for me, the 60s were both a time of incredible hopefulness, seeing possibility, and also having to reorganize everything I thought about this country as I began to see the deep underlying inequities that both racism coming around as a result of slavery, but also as a result of American, of European Americans' treatment of indigenous peoples. It was really quite unsettling. And when you talk about a divide between maybe right and left in this country, I think you could go either way. If your brain was being jumbled by all these experiences that were unsettling what your own childhood upbringing had been teaching you about the country, I can see you might easily go to the right as well as to the left.
Do you think that learning more, and your books are always, of course, about getting beneath the surface, learning more and more, often learning stuff that you don't really want to know. Do you think that learning more and more about your country, not just its virtues, but its vices, is similar to learning more and more about other individuals in love affairs or friendships or relationships within families?
To an extent, I might not push it too hard on that analogy. I think if you had I don't even know where I was going with that sentence. I think it depends on how much community you have and how much support you get from community as to how much you can take having the history unsettle you or just reorganize how you think. I'm not sure I'm saying that very clearly. If you were a loner who had always only had the experience maybe of abuse, you wouldn't expect any good result from anything you learned. Whereas maybe coming as I did, even from a position of relative privilege, I still had grounds for hope, maybe.
Well, let me sharpen that question. It was a bit vague at first. You came from Kansas, so the quintessential American state, right in the middle of the country, presented in all sorts of different ways throughout American culture. Was that, and I'm using this word, maybe you'll correct me, was the disappointment with America that you learned as you're growing up, did that inform your work and particularly your writing?
I started my public writing career quite a bit later. So I published my first novel when I was in my 30s. And by then, I was working at that time for a multinational financial services company. Mostly where I was working was insurance, property casualty, and mostly corporate insurance. And I started writing at the end of the Nixon era. So I went to work for this big company right in the wake of the Watergate hearings. And that was probably a more immediate sharpening of how I was looking at both the corporate world and the way that it played on. I'm going to give you a specific example. Workers' compensation insurance, companies buy it so that if a worker gets injured on the job, the insurance covers hospitalization, rehab, all those things. But nobody wants to pay insurance claims. I mean, companies fight them and insurers fight them. So that this insurance, which is supposed to be for the benefit of people working for a company, is very hard to get. And often years will go by before someone who's been injured on the job can get insurance. So I'm seeing this from the inside out. And I don't know, I mean, you have a British accent, so I'm not sure whether you're broadcasting more in the UK or more here, but if you're in America, you know that getting healthcare is really, it's hard to get and it's really hard to pay for, much more so than it was 40 years ago, but it was still hard then. So one of our the companies that we insured, they were a manufacturing company. And one of the people who worked there was a man whose daughter had a heart problem and needed surgery that the family could not afford and could not get insurance for. So he cut off his fingers in the table saw that he was using so that he could get compensated for the loss of his hand and so that he could afford to pay for his daughter's surgery. My company went and investigated that, as the Cat in the Hat said, with long rakes and red bats, and found out that this was a deliberate accident and denied coverage. So this guy's daughter could die and he could be out of work forever. And so it was more experiences like that up close and personal that really began informing my writing more than meta concepts of country and right, wrong, justice, injustice.
So you've got a new VI Warshawski or Warshawski, depends whether I'm talking to Americans or Poles or British people, a new book coming out next week, Pay Dirt, which in a sense, in terms of its narrative, is a return to American history. Do you think of it in that way, a re-examination or a rethinking or a reminder to your readers of some of the darker moments in American history?
I grew up in Kansas, as everyone knows by now, and Kansas came into the Union as a free state on January 29th, 1861. And that was the ultimate trigger that caused the South to fire on Fort Sumter and secede from the Union. I grew up thinking that we had been so heroic and wonderful. I was 4 years old when my family moved to Kansas. We celebrated the centennial of the town. We acted out pro-slavery forces controlled access into Kansas territory. And we girls acted out the anti-slavery women who sewed bullets into their petticoats to smuggle munitions past the slavery forces and into Kansas territory. My family stayed for the first 3 nights we lived there. We stayed in the hotel that had been the headquarters of the anti-slavery forces. Then, so I'm a very slow learner. I'm 76 now, so we're talking, 70 years. I read a book called This Is Not Dixie by Brett Campney. And in it, he detailed the amount of lynching and torture and property seizure and so on that took place in Kansas in the wake of the Civil War. And again, it was just another one of these like punch in the stomach awakenings that, I knew that the town that I grew up in was certainly had its racial divides. There was not a very large African American population there, but there were plenty of battles that were fought over civil rights in my hometown. But this book just opened my eyes in a painful way and in a depressing way to the reality on the ground throughout the country, really throughout the upper Midwest for sure, not so much the Western states, but for sure the Midwestern states. And, I thought I don't see how we're ever going to move past this as a country, how we're ever, I'm thinking things that been going on in my head for a long time. If you're an African American in America, in Chicago, in anywhere in America, you're going to pay a premium of about 30% more on a mortgage for a house than you will for the same.
Yeah, we just did a show on that actually yesterday with a couple.
So, it's just one injustice after another. And I'm thinking too much of the white part of the country grew up where this was, this kind of racial violence was just normal. And how are we ever going to move past it and have a more equitable country unless we can really think about it and come to terms with it? And so I suppose Pay Dirt, oh God, now I'm making it sound like a really boring kind of sermon of a novel, and I hope it's not. I hope it's entertaining for
people. I think everyone knows you don't write boring sermon, like certainly detective novels.
But I got my first hate letter this morning.
Oh, you did? You've never had one before?
Oh my God. No, I mean, my first hate letter for pay dirt. And it hasn't even hit the bookstores yet.
What did they say?
They said, kind of, this went straight into the garbage because it is garbage. And when I read a mystery, I want to be entertained. I don't want to lecture on wokeness. And I thought, God, there's no wokeness in this book. In fact, my one school teacher gets fired for even tiptoeing close to wokeness. He should have been excited to be supporting her local school board.
Well, I'm sure you're going to get a lot. Hate letters are good. It shows that you're having an impact. Sarah, I'm sure you're horribly bored by comparisons between yourself and V.I. Warszawski, your alter ego.
Warszawska, if you're in Poland.
Oh, Warszawska, if we're in Poland. And we do have some Polish listeners. You know, your alter ego, or maybe you're her alter ego, or she's yours. But I don't want to get into that. But she's your creation. Do you think, and she's known for being pretty tough and unshockable. Was she shocked by some of these stories from the Civil War that Pay Dirt gets into?
I think she feels overwhelmed more than shocked. I think she's close to being killed for her investigation. She's sitting in a coal-fueled power plant that was supposed to be mothballed and is just coming creakily back on stream, and she's supposed to die there. And she's just feeling overwhelmed and depressed more than shocked.
What could shock her if she's not shocked by this?
I think that what would shock her would be, my stories often very predictably have evil billionaires in them. And then I'm thinking the governor of Illinois, J.B. Pritzker, he's a billionaire. And really, we're so in love with him. We can't believe what a good job he's doing, how much he's doing for women and all these things. We're like, is there a billionaire that we really want to hug and kiss? But in my books, those are not the kind of billionaires who show up. And what would shock her would be if these billionaires would suddenly have a so-called come to Jesus moment and think, oh my God, we were doing all these wicked things and now we're going to stop because we have all this money and we could do some good with it instead of killing more people to make ourselves even richer. That would shock her.
Well, I don't think that's going to come, is it? She's not going to be shocked.
Probably not, but you never know.
Well, hopefully one day. Will it ever end, this history, Sarah? I mean, it's been going on now for more than 200 years. More, really, if you include the history of slavery. Is there any hope, not only in the book, but in your own reading of American history, that we can get beyond this, not just this original sin, but this terrible wound within the country?
Well, I think it's possible, but you would have to have people like the so-called former guy stop fomenting a sense of grievance among some of the America's white population. The thing that gives me hope, if I have to live without hope, I might as well stop living. But when I see the amount of energy that young people of all races and genders and so on are putting into working for the country, trying to work on, some are working on healthcare, some are working on climate, some are working on just on getting out the vote, and I think, you know, there's a tremendous amount of optimism, even while they're scared about what the future is holding for them, tremendous amount of energy. And I feel like that was kind of my generation too. It was a very tall mountain to climb, but we really thought that if we put enough energy into it, we could climb that mountain, we could make a difference. And I think we did make a difference to some degree. even if not as big a degree as is needed. So, yeah, I have some hope. I'm terrified, actually. I'm terrified looking at November. But if we can get past November, I think maybe we can start to rebuild.
When it comes to hope, do you think that your dominant genre, the crime novel, is it a good vehicle, or is it a vehicle that's not really ideal for hopeful messages and hopeful people?
You know, there's a Mexican crime writer, and I've lost touch with him, so I have to say honestly, I don't know if he's still alive. Paco Taibo, T-A-I-B-O, who felt that in Mexico, the crime novel was the only possible political novel because it was the one form of fiction that was flew below the radar. Censors weren't interested in it. And I think in a broad general way, the crime novel can do things that general fiction can't do. It can talk to people about law and justice because that's where they naturally occur. They naturally occur on the pages of a crime novel. I'd say that way too many crime novels are more concerned with graphic sex and violence than they are with actually even telling much of a story. But that if you're really trying to tell a good story, then you're showing how people are reacting in the middle of the most extreme things that can happen to them. If you're taking that seriously, then the crime novel is the best kind of book to write and to read.
I mean, as you noted earlier, your good is a good is, your bad is a bad is. But what about in a book like Patricia Highsmith's Ripley series? I was just watching the series on Netflix this weekend, when the hero isn't really a hero.
Right. I think you're looking at someone who is an extraordinarily gifted storyteller, and she could take us on a journey to anywhere.
What do you think VI would think of Tom Ripley?
Oh, gosh. I think VI, I think Tom Ripley would look at her and say, ah, petite bourgeoise. She has such a middle-class sense of morality and right and wrong, and he was someone who could certainly rise above all that. Or sink below it, I'm not sure which. Anyway, sidestep it. And I'm afraid that that's where she and I are most alike. I feel like I'm just pathetically a victim of middle-class morality.
What's wrong with that?
Well, it's where I live, so better be okay.
And what is middle-class morality for you?
Oh,
Knowing the difference between good and evil?
Say what?
Knowing the difference between good and evil? I asked you what middle-class morality is, or what you call petty bourgeois morality.
No, I think I was thinking of Liza Doolittle's father and his being a victim of middle-class morality and being forced to get married, which I think it used to have everything to do with sex, but now today, to me, it feels like more like... you know, so there's a passage, and I think it's the prophet Amos, it might be Micah, where it talks about justice being like a plumb line, making the earth line up in a straight way. And that when you lose that plumb line, when you're willing to do anything for money or power, then you've lost your sense of justice, and the plumb line is no longer holding the earth steady. And to me, that's what real morality is a commitment to justice, but not justice without charity.
Another show I was rewatching recently was Ken Burns's wonderful documentary about the Jazz Age, in which Kansas really features centrally.
Really? I didn't watch it.
You should see it. It's really good. But now when we read about Kansas, we don't read about it as a cultural center. I was there a few years ago at the Truman Center to do some interviews. And it struck me as a place without much of a heart, literally, physically, at least, the city. What happened to Kansas, Sarah? What has happened?
First of all, I'm sorry to be a nitpicker, but the Truman Center is in Missouri.
I apologize.
Not in Kansas. We're too moral for... No, sorry. If you're in Kansas City, Kansas, you get one version of the history of the Civil War. If you're in, and this is today, right now, 2024. If you're in Kansas City, Missouri, you get a very different version. And those have to do with the two states' histories as slave state versus free state. So as to what happened to Kansas, I can't answer that question because I don't know. But Kansas had a pretty alt-right governor named Brownback. And I can't even remember how long ago, 15 years ago, something like that. I think it was during the W years. It might have been during the early Barack years. Anyway, every state has has the opportunity to have a state arts association, and Kansas did. And if you have a state arts association, the federal government will give you $8 for every dollar you spend on the arts. So little theaters, little music groups, every kind of arts group you can imagine flourished in little Kansas towns because we had this arts council. I was invited down, given an honor of being an outstanding Kansas writer. And the same week that the governor decided to close the Kansas Arts Council so that we weren't beholden to the federal government for money anymore. So I was part of a lobbying effort to try to get the legislature to overturn this. And all the people from the little towns who had little theaters and all these things were there testifying in vain, because nothing was going to change either the legislature or the governor. And then they would go home and vote for these people again and not see the connection between what they were depriving their town of and what they were voting into office. So I don't know that, I just think that operating on people's fears has proven so successful for so many centuries, really. Not just in Kansas, but everywhere. I think one of the most depressing and grief-inducing books I ever read was Isabel Wilkerson's Caste, where she talked about how Hitler studied Jim Crow laws as he was ramping up for the Final Solution, and how you can get an entire country on board with something truly disgusting and horrific just by operating on their fears. And so I don't know. Woo, now I'm depressed. What time is it? Is it time for me to jump out the window yet?
Well, don't do it on screen. Yeah, I saw did you see the film about the Wilkerson book?
No, I haven't yet seen it.
It's good. Couple more questions and then we'll let you jump out the window.
It'll be your fault too, Andrew, for sending me down.
Yeah, I'll take responsibility. Well, I'm more like Ripley in that sense. I won't really feel that bad.
petite bourgeoise. Look at her. She couldn't handle the truth.
Did you ever read Thomas Frank's book about what's the matter with Kansas?
Do you have any
thoughts on his thesis?
I can't explain why I didn't read it. Maybe I found it too threatening. I'm certainly aware of it.
Yeah, it's an interesting book, and Frank's been on the show. One more question, and then we'll end with America. I'm not going to give away all the plot because we want everyone to buy Pay Dirt next week when it's out. But one thing that I thought you're very prescient on is one of the pieces of the narrative features female college basketball. And of course, last weekend, female college basketball broke all the records. More people are watching the girl basketball than the boy basketball. Did you predict that? Are you a sports person?
Oh, I follow women's college basketball. I've just been very excited to see these young women come into their own. So, and the University of Kansas team is kind of in the middle of the pack, but I have a brother who still lives in Lawrence, Kansas, where the university is, and he and his wife are big boosters, so I see a lot of games with them.
Did you enjoy writing about college basketball in Payday?
Yes, I did. And my detective, V.I. Warszawski in America, Warszawska in Poland, she played high school basketball for when she was growing up in Chicago. And she went to the University of Chicago on a basketball scholarship.
Yeah, well, I have to introduce her to my wife. She's a big basketball fan. Finally, Sarah, don't need me to remind you that in a couple of years' time, July 2026, America will be 250 years old. A couple of easy questions for you to answer. Firstly, will you be celebrating in July 2026, this anniversary, this birthday?
Oh, I don't know. It depends on where we are as a country then.
Well, yeah, it's hard to know that, of course. And secondly, where should America go for the next 50 years after 2026? Where's its unfinished business? You write about a kind of unfinished business in Pay Dirt, but two simple questions to end with.
Oh, yeah, that's easy. You know, we have such a big footprint in the world, and it's not an easy thing to contemplate, I guess. So maybe it would be nice if we put on smaller shoes and let other people walk around a little bit more.
One, this is Andrew. Welcome to Keen on America. On July 4th, 2026, America will be 250 years old, an anniversary that will, no doubt, be greeted with a mixture of celebration, contemplation, and resignation. In Keen on America, we talk to prominent US citizens, not just about their country's past and present, but also about its future. What, I ask my American guests, will be the 21st century fate of their now venerable republic?